This week on Vox Talks, what have we learned and what should we learn from the Irish crisis of 2010? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, today I'm at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in London for the launch of Currency, Credit and Crisis, Central Banking in Ireland and Europe by Patrick Honohan. In September 2009, Patrick took over as governor of the Central Bank of Ireland. It was not by any means a dream job. Unemployment and emigration were up, GDP was way down, and every bank in Ireland needed the guarantee of financial support that the government had offered them a year earlier. Ireland was caught up in the emerging euro area crisis, and it was in danger of default. Now Patrick has relived the events of those years in his book. He tells about how Ireland's economy survived and eventually recovered, but it also draws out lessons for central banks, policymakers and politicians for the next crisis. And Patrick joins me now. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Thank you, Tim.
It was not a dream job. So is it true that when you took over the governor's job, you were told by one of your predecessors that we're counting on you to save the country from national humiliation?
Ah, yes. That was T.K. Whittaker. He was Ireland's legendary public servant, died just a couple of years ago now at the age of 100. Of course, it depends on what you call a dream job. Nothing could have been more interesting than to be involved in this crisis. His view is an old-fashioned view that it was the role of the central bank to look after the money and money things, a more interventionist view, a more active view than we often see today. And I think it was that that was putting it to him to ask me to, you know, straighten things out, which was my job anyway.
Well, yes, and immediately before you took over, the job of the central bank, of many central banks, had been perceived to be much more passive, hadn't it? Your book draws out the lessons from a crisis about the roles and responsibilities of central banks and what we've learned about that. Do you think sometimes we get too focused on the narrative of the crisis and retelling what happened and who was in the room when a decision was made, and then give too little attention about what we should learn afterwards?
Well, yes and no. I do think the narrative is important. It's important to get facts right, and the recollection of facts can get skewed over time, people highlighting things that may be more or less important. I think it's also important to understand why things happened in the way they did and what choices were made by people who had decisions to make. So I think all of those combine to forming the lessons that we can draw.
You also make the point in the book that most central banks, like the Central Bank of Ireland, are small, but yet we tend to think about central banking as big central banks, the actions and the policies of the Fed or the ECB. Should we be paying more attention to what small central banks do?
I think small central banks, and as you say, most countries are small and have to deal with the outside world through their small national central banks. They're engaged in a different kind of activity. They're responding to external pressures. They're maneuvering. They're not setting the scene, the global scene of the monetary and financial affairs. They're responding and adjusting and adapting. And that's particularly true in places like the euro area, where there are national central banks, even though they're part of the euro area-wide system. I think also in small countries, national central banks are called on to do a bit more. They're usually the repository of financial wisdom in the public sector, if they do have that. But I mean, they should have that ambition, and to be advisors to government and to the nation. And they're very often involved in all dimensions of financial regulation, as well as keeping the price level stable.
Those extra responsibilities are something that very much came home to you in 2009, 2010. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, we've also been joined by Martin Sambu, who's European economics commentator at the Financial Times. And we're going to talk about the Irish crisis and some of its implications. Martin, welcome.
Thank you.
We talk about, Martin, the pre-crisis boom in Ireland and in other countries in Europe, as if we knew all along that these actions were reckless and it would all end in tears. But it wasn't like that, was it?
Well, there is that phrase, irrational exuberance, that everyone kind of gets caught up in a crisis. There were very few people who saw how unstable things were before the crisis. This is not just true in smaller economies like Ireland or Iceland. It's true in the US too, where most economists were quite relaxed about the growth in credit, thought that markets have a handle on this, banks will price their risks correctly, and so on. And there were a few lone voices who warned about instability and that things could go badly wrong. But they were a tiny minority, and this was true across the board. So, yes, I think you're right. Most people got caught up in the game.
And I think in a couple of countries, Ireland being a prime example, there are what Robert Shiller describes as this narratives, plausible but untrue narratives, which say this time is different. In the Irish case, I think it was, look, we have the Celtic Tiger. We're a miracle economy. We could grow to be the Singapore of Europe. And that narrative sustained Ireland's ability to sweep in funds from the very rapidly increasing financialization of the world economy until it was way too late and way too big.
I think this Shiller point about narratives is really important, actually. It's a really useful way to think about how things can go wrong without us realizing. And Patrick, you were talking about the kind of general society or the political debate, but I think it's also true of economists, even professional economists, that there's a bit of openness in economic theory and economic models. You can usually find ways to rationalize things in a way that makes you say, well, this looks okay, you know, because people have chosen this, so they have reason to choose it, and so they obviously know what they're doing. And there was some of that happening. I mean, it's kind of what you heard in Alan Greenspan's analysis of the crisis, for example, until everything collapsed, and he said there was a flaw in my model. Well, now you tell us. But my point is just humans, including professional economists, have this tendency to kind of rationalize what they see in front of them.
And I think people use risk management techniques, which they should have known were not 100% good. They were 98% good, and the 2% was what was going to cause the problem. I think that's a flaw. It's economics, but it's also financial management. Very complex mathematical models, but despite their complexity, their ability to capture tail events was known to be imperfect, and yet people use them as if it was perfect.
Yeah, known to be imperfect, but assumed to be adequate.
In 2009, when you took over on the top job, had that feeling that if you just hang on, maybe it'll be all right, had that gone away at that time?
Pretty much. Already, employment had collapsed because construction had collapsed. Already, major losses at the banks were evident. The question was, could we possibly navigate through this and make the adjustment without a catastrophic loss of market confidence? And that's what we didn't manage to do, but it probably didn't make much difference. I was a year into the job when market confidence finally eroded, when we had to say, well, we've done the sums now on the bank losses, and they are actually bigger than, much bigger than were disclosed by the banks or imagined by the banks. And they're at the outer limit of what we had known to be the possible range in September 2009.
Did you think all along that you would end up negotiating a bailout?
What I was afraid of is that something that I would do would trigger an unnecessary bailout.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly an IMF program was the backstop, which I always envisaged that, if worst comes to the worst, we'll go to the IMF.
Now let's have a look at 2010, when that deal with the IMF, the Troika, was negotiated. Do you feel at the end of that you got the best deal you could have got?
No, I was disappointed with the deal at that stage. And you know, I had to advise the government, should you go for this or do something else? Mm. And I said, you go for this because it's the best way forward now. But it's not as good as we could have hoped for, given what I expected to be a better collegiality in Europe, a better ability of these mighty institutions, the IMF and so on, to do a transaction, a contract with us that would reduce the tail risk that was still there from the banking system. Instead, they just gave a loan, which left all the tail risk with Ireland. And the third thing that was wrong with the program at that point was that the interest rates were very high. We were borrowing multiples, 20-something times IMF quota, and that meant huge surcharges according to the IMF standard schedules. These were very unusually large loans for the IMF. And so the interest rates were very high. It was quite possible they could not be paid. Fortunately, because of politics, those interest rates were lowered within 6 months, politics related mainly to Greece.
But if they hadn't have been lowered, then it would have been kicking the default down the road.
Yeah.
Looking at it from the outside, Martin.
Well, since I look at it from the outside, I can be less polite than Patrick has to be about some of his former colleagues. I mean, I think the European institutions behaved outrageously, really, towards Ireland. There was clearly a market panic. There was clearly a fast-moving expectation that there would be some sort of, I don't like the word, bailout or rescue, a loan, because a loan was what it was. There were a number of policy conditions that were put on that loan package that preempted the Irish government's ability to make some choices of its own. And they were unnecessary, in my view, at the time and certainly now. Probably bad choices. I mean, one thing that was beginning to be debated was whether to start writing down some of the senior debt of these private banks. That was very much a sort of non-mainstream view at the time. It has since become pretty much European policy. At the time, it was very controversial, but I think Patrick will agree that there's no doubt that the European institutions very much shut down that debate. And by the time a rescue loan was agreed, a certain condition was that Ireland would not be allowed to go down that route.
Yes, it's quite unusual to or surprising to think that what is now policy in Europe, that you must not bail out senior bondholders, you must not use public funds in that way, was exactly the opposite to the pressure that was put on Ireland. Now, having said that, a lot of those decisions to bail out had been already been taken by the Irish government, but there still was a block of money that could have been bailed in. In the end, as I describe in the book, the financial arrangements that were settled on between the ECB and the central bank and the government later on actually reduced the burden of that remaining portion quite considerably. So I think they felt bad about it and allowed those arrangements to be made.
You're surprisingly positive in the book about some of the consequences of that agreement. You say that perhaps there has been too much blame heaped on the Troika for what happened consequent to the agreement.
Well, as I've already said, there were drawbacks, but I think that in quantitative terms, these were less important issues than the big adjustments that had to be made. Now, it's still worth fighting over them, and I would like to have got more, but it is what it is, and the economy recovered reasonably rapidly and robustly after that.
I think it's worth mentioning the numbers here. Ireland went from about 25% of GDP public debt before the crisis to something like 125% a couple of years into it, once things stabilized. Yeah. So that's one whole year worth of economic production that is now current and future Irish taxpayers, a burden on them. That was a result partly because of Irish government mistakes, but partly also, I think, because of the policy conditions put down by the European institutions.
True, but of that jump of 100% of GDP, probably about 25% at the very most, 22, 23% relate to bank bailouts, and maybe 3 or 4% to the part of the bank bailouts for which the Europeans muscled in. So, you know, it's not the whole story. It's marginal in terms of did Ireland have a crisis or not have a crisis. 2 or 3% of GDP is a lot of money, but it's not 100% of GDP.
Now, we don't get to rewrite history, but a country like Ireland will potentially go down this road again, maybe in the near future. Is there a better way that political and economic decisions can be taken in future?
Yes and no. Yes, there is a better way. Mm-hmm. Will it be implemented? Will policy be effective? That's less clear. Banks are much more capitalized than they were. The bail-in, bail-out procedures, the BRRD is in place. There are laws that facilitate, in fact, oblige banks to absorb the losses themselves through their shareholders and their bondholders. What I would be less confident about is whether we have the capacity as regulators, supervisors, to see what's going wrong. The regulations on banks and other financial institutions have become very, very complex now, a risk that we can't see the wood for the trees because everybody says, no, we went through all the regulations and they're all satisfied. And also the fear that when it comes to the crunch, although the procedures are there, that the politicians will hesitate to take the tough action that might rebound on them. What I saw in the crisis was a lot of panic by policymakers that if we take this step, we could be precipitating something bad.
I would echo that. There are now tools that make it easier to take a different course. There is more equity capital to write down. There's more capital that can be converted into equity. And there are rules in place to make debt behave like equity, make the investors in the banks take the loss. But we still haven't seen a case where those tools have been used to the full. There have been some bank resolutions in Europe in the last couple of years in places like Spain and Italy. None of them so far have made full use of these new tools. And I think the reason is precisely, as Patrick says, it's politics. It's politically perceived, at least, as painful to really restructure a private bank. It's a little bit surprising because even more sort of populist parties that should find it very congenial to say punish the banks, punish the creditors. Even they are not very comfortable doing this. It's a big question why this is. Why is the political psychology so much against restructuring bank debt? We could spend the whole evening talking about that. But that, I think, is the big question when the next time there's a crisis that means that this is what you have to do. Will politicians, in the end, who are the regulators' bosses, allow it to happen and make full use of the rules as they know how?
I think there's another dimension also. This matters most for the very large banks, the systemically important banks. These are the ones that could, if the public finances are asked to bear the losses, it could cause systemic problems. And in that case, these banks are not only large, but they are highly complex. And I think that the resolution rules are there. Most resolution authorities are not ready to resolve safely very, very large banks. They acknowledge that. Some of them very publicly acknowledge that the large banks, yes, they're working on it, they have resolution plans, but if they were asked to implement them in the morning, it would be messy. And it might be a couple of years or more before they're really ready to do this with confidence.
Are there lessons from what happened between 2010 and 2013 that the supervisory authorities, the regulators, are yet to absorb and they could really do with thinking more about?
This is a difficult question to answer. I think the moves have been in the right direction, but I think they have led to a complexity that is dangerous. In some cases, they have exaggerated problems of liquidity as opposed to capital. They've emphasized capital too. But the emphasis on ensuring that every firm has ample liquidity could be damaging the economy more than is necessary. Liquidity is what central banks can provide in a panic at zero social cost if they apply it correctly and safely. And this is not what has inspired the elaborate rules about liquidity maintenance. So there's some things that I would want to correct, but the general move has been in the right direction. The risk is that people will be complacent about the steps that have been taken being sufficient.
I agree that the directional travel has been the right one. I would say that, and we may differ a bit here, I would say that what regulators and policymakers, where they're still stuck in what I think is the wrong framework, is that they worry too much about the costs of adding capital requirements or other forms of regulation relative to the cost of what happens when things go wrong. In my view, there's still too much worry that burdening the system is going to be bad for growth now, as opposed to foolproofing the system to avoid the cost if things go wrong.
Certainly, we've had repeated crises. Crises are not rare things, they are frequent things. And one thing that we learned from this last crisis, which was the biggest crisis, is that we'll never have solved and eliminated all the possibility of crises.
Finally, Patrick, if you're asked to step in again, save Ireland's reputation again, would you do it?
Oh, you mean to another unpleasant and undesirable job? Of course I would, but getting old now.
I think probably once is enough for anyone. Patrick and Martin, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Patrick's book is called Currency, Credit and Crisis, Central Banking in Ireland and Europe, and it's published by Cambridge University Press. And if you want a flavour of the book, you can read Patrick's Vox EU column from earlier in 2019, called The Irish Crisis, Lessons for Small Central Banks. Also, historians of economics can find a column on VoxEU written in 2009 by Patrick with Philip Lane, and that was called Ireland, How to Fix the Looming Banking and Public Finance Crises, which was written, I note, only a few months before you actually got the job of fixing them. So the lesson is, be careful what you post on VoxEU. I'd also recommend a very relevant Vox talk from 2016, and that's called Europe's Orphan, the Future of the Euro and the Politics of Debt. And that is Martin in conversation with my colleague Ramesh Vaitalingam. You can find that in the Vox Talk archive at voxeu.org/vox-talks. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We're here every Friday, so subscribe on your podcast platform. We're on most of them. For a new episode every week.